next Monday was Memorial Day, a holiday celebrated in the United States since the Civil War to remember those who fought and who were killed in the wars where Americans fought and died. I've always had mixed emotions about Memorial Day. Let me tell you why. My father was a veteran, and he served and fought in World War II. I didn't know much about his experience until I was 11 years of age. My dad didn't talk about the war. He didn't want to. In fact, whenever we would watch a war show on television, I remember when I was a child or wanted to go to a war movie, my dad wouldn't let us, and he would always get up and turn the channel, or he would leave the room when a war movie came on. My dad wrote an article when I was 11 years old in the Portfolio, which was the magazine of Ambassador College, in 1958 about his experiences. And when I read the article when I was 11, that was the first time I had heard about some of my father's experiences. My father joined the Army at the beginning of the war, World War II, and he was scheduled to land at Normandy. But in the hold of the ship, as he left Boston and they sailed to England, he got pneumonia, very serious double pneumonia, and he had to go into a hospital as soon as he got to England. And so his platoon shipped across the English Channel, and they landed at Normandy, and most of his platoon was wiped out. So all of the men that he had trained with basically died at the landing of Normandy. Well, he healed up, and he actually landed at Normandy, but after the beach had basically been settled and cleared of the Nazis. He then joined Patton's 3rd Army Division, which had marched up from Italy, and they were then marching east towards Belgium and Germany. And my father experienced the Battle of the Bulge, which many of you may have heard of. A lot of high casualties. Even the new acquaintances and new friends that my dad had made, apparently he saw die in that battle. And he told me once of the experience of one of his friends standing next to him. He was in the armored division. They were working with tanks and armament, but one of his best friends was killed. And the remains of his friend landed on him. And because they were in the middle of war, they were on him for about 3 days. That kind of thing has an effect on you, as you might imagine. He was with Patton's initial platoon when they liberated Buchenwald death camp in Germany. That, too, left a lasting impression on him. In that camp, being one of the first ones in the camp, he saw the piles of emaciated dead bodies of the prisoners in that camp. He also saw the atrocities of the Nazis. When he went into the commandant's cabin or barracks, he noticed that on the couch were pillows filled with human hair. In his article, he wrote about the lampshades made out of human skin. He witnessed firsthand the ovens and the atrocities of that particular prison camp, which they say nearly equaled Dachau. Well, if that experience wasn't bad enough, my father then was assigned as a guard at Dachau death camp, where the Nazi criminals and prisoners, and these were some of the higher-ups in the Nazi party, were housed while they were waiting for the Nuremberg trials, which you may remember, if you're a historian of World War II, took place immediately after the war and the Nazi hierarchy was gathered together, and they were housed literally in Dachau death camp, where so many of the Jews and Poles were killed during the war by the Nazis. And he saw, and he actually fed and cared for those men, most of whom were sentenced to death after the Nuremberg trials. In 1946, he returned back to the United States, and because of what had occurred in the war that he participated in and witnessed firsthand, didn't want to talk about the war, and didn't for the better part of the next 13 years. Like I said, it was only after he was called into the church and went to Ambassador College and was encouraged to write about his experiences. So he wrote an article that was reprinted several times from the Portfolio magazine at Ambassador College. He talked about and wrote about the evil and destructiveness of the war in that article, and he began to talk to us, my brother and I, about the effects of war. He grew to hate the fruit of war, as you might imagine. It was only after he was called to the church that he can even begin to talk about it. I guess the question I want to address today is, what should Christians think about war? Does the Bible, the words of Christ, and Scripture support war? Many of you probably read the song or heard the song. You can read the lyrics, at least the opening lyrics of John Lennon's song, Imagine. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. I believe we would agree with John Lennon and most people who want peace. I would think that everybody in this room would want peace. We all want peace of mind, and I believe deep down inside we all want peace among human beings. We just don't know how to get it, do we? We don't know how to obtain it. There's lots of political talk now, some of which is about war and, you know, what it would be like to elect someone who would have the briefcase with the red phone in it, who would have at his disposal the button that could begin to annihilate man off the earth. There's been a lot of discussion in this political arena in the United States about war and what they might do under certain circumstances. But I think we would all agree that our world today is without peace. And there are quite a number of wars, and we're going to get into that a little bit as we get into this sermon. My question is, why? Why is there no peace today? Why must we continue to have a memorial day that remembers men and women who have died in war, fighting wars? Well, let's begin in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24, verse 6. This is called the Olivet Prophecy, and this was the prophecy in which Jesus Christ told us that there would be wars and rumors of wars until his return. Notice verse 6. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. Now, clearly, my dad was troubled by what he saw. Thankfully, most of us don't have to see war up close like that. Most of us, in the comfort of our living rooms, can turn the channel, or we can turn off the images. And if you're like me, after a while you get enough of it and you want to turn it off. The trouble is, it doesn't go away just because we turn it off. That suffering continues. But he told his disciples, "See that you are not troubled." Now when you think about the disciples to whom he's speaking, you know that these 12 men indeed saw wars. Many of them had to flee Jerusalem because of the encroaching Roman army that came to destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD. They fled to other parts of the empire. Most of them fled north to Antioch and to Pella and to Ephesus from Jerusalem. So these things really began to seriously occur in their lifetime. That's why he said, "See that you are not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Wars and rumors of war. "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." And the sorrows of war and the fallout of war, which includes famines and pestilences, occur as the result of war. War is a very unpleasant event. I think we would all agree. But there have been over 2,500 major armed conflicts since Christ's prophecy. 2,500 major armed conflicts. There are a lot that we don't know about because, of course, they were between tribes or they were between individual families grown large in remote areas that historians maybe are not aware of. They oftentimes, in fact, just recently, they dug up, you know, a burial site that had hundreds of remains in it, hundreds of bodies of remains. They don't know how they got there. At some point, there was a mass grave, and they stumbled across this as they were digging over in Rome, actually. They were digging a subway in Rome and found all these bodies. Where'd they come from? Well, they're not sure. At this point, they can only guess, because the graves are unmarked, but probably a result of war. I did a little research, and I thought I would just share with you. I don't know if you can see this or not, but it's a graphic that I copied and put into my PowerPoint. During the years 900 to 1450, a current era, Europeans, where most of the skirmishes occurred naturally, lost some 435,000 men on the battlefield. Over a course of over 500 years. I want you to remember this because we're going to refer to numbers that are more recent in just a moment and compare them a little bit. Over 550 years, we had nearly 500,000 men die on the battlefield. Now remember, during this time period, gunpowder had not been discovered yet, right? Or at least promulgated. They mainly killed each other with arrows and spears and swords and other merciless forms of death we won't get into. But again, almost 500,000 men died on the battlefield during these 550 years. What I'd like to do next is jump ahead closer to where we're living and look at the awful and unspeakable evil man has done to other men since the 15th century. I call these the 15 highest casualty events. These are actually the 15 worst things people have done to one another, and the death toll for each since 1450. We'll start with number 15 at the top of the list. You see the death toll on the left, and on the right is the particular cause or event. 3 million people during the Chinese Civil War. 5 million people in the Congo, in the Free State Wars. 7 million during the 30 Years' War in Europe. 8 million in the fall of the Roman Empire. You can read on down the list. I won't read it all, but I want you to notice as time moves forward, the number of men and women and children who died, the casualty rate continues to rise. So as we look at the 500 years which followed 1450 up to the 20th century, let's see the higher number of casualties and events and the death toll, and you see how it rises. We finally get to World War II, the Second World War in which my father fought. 50 million people lost their lives in that war. 50 million. The hundreds of millions of people who died in the last 500 years up to the 21st century dwarfs the previous 550 years, doesn't it, in terms of casualties. So instead of things getting better in the world, in reality, the wars and rumors of wars that Christ prophesied have only multiplied exponentially and gotten worse. Let's look at the summary of the 20th century. $33 million military casualties. 170 million killed in conflicts of non-international character, that is, internal conflicts and tyrannical regime victimization, purges of ethnicities that are primarily minorities. 55 million dead from the effects of war, for a total of 258 million people killed in the last century. 258 million. That's almost the population of the United States in the 20th century. But let's talk about the number of wars in the 21st century, since, you know, a lot of people say, well, we're now enlightened. Let's take a look at this. In the 21st century, war fatalities. 2001, the Afghanistan Liberation War, in which the United States and the United Kingdom were fighting against the Taliban, 40,000 casualties. 2001 also, Nigeria versus the Boko Haram, 20,000 people dead. The Ivory Coast Civil War, 1,000. The second Iraqi-U.S. War, 160,000 lives lost. Sudan and the Darfur region wars, 300,000. We don't know how many were lost in the Sudan Eritrea wars or the Yemen Hutu wars. Those numbers are not even able to be discovered in completeness. More recently, 2004, 2007, Pakistan and the Pakistani Taliban, 38,000 lives lost. 2011, Iraq Civil War, 150,000 lives lost. Syria Civil War, 320,000 casualties so far. We don't know how many have been lost in the ISIS-Syrian-Iraqi conflict. South Sudan versus the rebels, 10,000 people. Ukraine Civil War, 6,000 known dead. And of course, there's more than just casualties to consider. Again, another chart that I pulled off the internet. The number of people displaced by war has reached an incredibly new high. Refugees displaced by war in the past 10 years. These are people who have to flee the conflict and either move out of their hometown or their city, and many of them into other countries. And we know it's on the news all the time about the refugee problem for Europe now. Over the last 10 years, a staggering 448 million people have been displaced from their homes because of war. One in every 122 people on the earth is now either a refugee, internally displaced, or seeking asylum in another country. Let's talk about significant armed conflicts going on right now as you and I sit here, and that have gone on since 2008. You notice the number of conflicts has actually gone down. But that's the only good news. Notice the number of casualties has gone up. 2008, 56,000. 2010, 49,000. 2012, 110,000. 2014, the latest figures I could find, 180,000. Notice how the number of casualties keeps rising. Notice the number of conflicts. Going down a bit, but the number of casualties keeps going up. A lot of people say, well, you know, America seeks peace. I'd like to share with you a quote by this is Brian Ferguson, who's a history professor at Rutgers University, talking about America. He says, "War has always been a central icon of civilization. Ours, for instance, war is the crucible that cooked it, the shield that defends it. America is a story of war. What we think about the nature of war affects our vision of its present and future." I was watching something as innocuous as the NBA Finals the other day. Some of you may have joined me in watching Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. That's all I'm going to say on the Sabbath about it. But I was amazed at the advertisements. Maybe you noticed this too. The advertisements were all about video war games. Or advertisements for war movies. And I thought, yeah, a little competition kind of stirs your blood, you know. And you go, yeah, you know, I hope my team wins. The competition, it's built into sports. We all know about that. But I thought, isn't it awful that sponsors, advertisers, take advantage of that sense of emotion to sell the games that are available today, most of which, based on what I saw, I mean, my son's played Pong. And now you've got these very graphically oriented, very sophisticated war games that kids can play and get into. It only promulgates what Professor Ferguson says about America and its history and its culture and its orientation. Well, let's notice a little bit about the church and its history and war in this topic. War in the church. For the first 300 years of the church, there is no record of support among Christians for war and military service. Absolutely no support. And you might say, well, why? Well, first of all, Christ's comments about warfare and enemies, which we're going to read in just a moment. And secondarily, the pagan practices that were so prevalent among the Roman military, which was the predominant military force of the first 300 years of the church. You know, a lot of young men have asked me over the years, what do you think? Should I volunteer to go into the military service? And I say, well, if you were living in the first century church, would you join the Roman army? Oh, no. I say, well, why? Well, you know, they have a reputation for being brutal and despotic and militaristic and imperialistic. And, you know, you've all heard war. I mean, the stories about Roman gladiators and Roman soldiers. And I say, so you think war today is any better than it was during the time of the Romans? We just went through the facts. So these are the main two reasons for the first 300 years that Christians did not involve themselves in military service. There is no historical record of true Christians as we know them involved in military service and war. It was only at the time of Constantine, when Constantine tried to bring the empire together, bring the pagans in with the Romans, and put the Christian candy coat on top of it, that then there was a concept that was developed, which I'll get into in just a minute, called the just war. But first of all, let's go to the words of Christ. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5, verse 38. Matthew 5, 38. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38, this, of course, is called the Beatitudes. Matthew 5, 6, 7, and 8. And at the beginning of these Beatitudes in Matthew 5, Christ says some things that are pretty hard for some people who like war to take. Verse 38, Christ said, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." And oftentimes that's the way it was in the Old Testament. And God there said, you may recall, he said, look, you don't have to lift a sword. You don't have to lift a spear. You don't have to shoot an arrow. I will clear out these people in front of you, before you. You don't have to burn their cities. You don't have to starve them out. He says, I'll send hornets in. And I don't care how big you are, the Anak, Goliath, or how thick your armor is. When you've got hornets in your armor, you're done with war. Let me tell you, right? You're finished. And God told him that in Deuteronomy. He says, don't fight. I will clear these people out in front of you. I promised this land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants, and you're going to get it. 430 years later, you're going to inherit it. But no, they wanted to be like their neighbors, and they wanted to fight. And so God said, okay, if you fight, you're going to die. You're going to die in great numbers. And they did. As you all know, the history of ancient Israel. But Christ says something else here, verse 39. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Very difficult to do, isn't it? Verse 40. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Verse 41, and whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use and persecute you. Why? So that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain upon the just and the unjust. But we are called to a higher calling. Let's go to John 18, verse 36. Christ was encountered, you may remember, by Judas and the mob, and he was about to be arrested. And you may remember that Peter pulled out the sword and did what most fishermen do with a sword. Didn't have a very accurate shot. Swung his sword and knocked off an ear. I mean, you couldn't do that if you wanted to, unless, of course, you were a fisherman and you mainly dealt with nets, and suddenly you find yourself with a sword. And so following all that, we get to verse 36 and the accusations that Pilate asked him, you know, are you a king and do you have a kingdom? And in verse 36, John 18, verse 36, Jesus answered and said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. And I hope by the facts we've just read, we know that God's kingdom is not on earth yet. Next, let's go to James chapter 4. James 4. Because we find the source clearly laid out in the Bible of wars. What causes wars? What's the underlying motives? What are the underlying causes? James chapter 4, verse 1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? James asks. Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war is in your members? It's exciting. It's stimulating. You can ask any kid who plays video games. He'll tell you. Verse 2, you lust and do not have. Aha. Most wars are caused by imperialistic goals and desires. We want more territory. We know what the Russians have done recently in Crimea, right? We know what the Chinese are now attempting to do by creating islands in the Sea of China. They want more territory, more land, more resources, more people, more power. They come from lust. You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. We don't seek what we want from God. We seek it instead from what we believe to be is our power. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. And on it goes. The Bible is pretty clear, I think, from the words of Christ and where we know that war normally comes from. I'd like to briefly talk about what happened in the 3rd century. Before the 3rd century, the early, what they call church fathers in the Catholic tradition, for example, Clement of Alexandria and Origen, they wrote against military service. It wasn't until the 4th century when Constantine became a Christian that writers and church leaders began to encourage Christians to serve in the military. And the concept of the just war was developed and argued. This comes from the book When God Says War is Right by Darrell Cole. This particular quote in the next one on the next page, the next screen. Ambrose of Milan, 340 to 397, developed the just war concept in the 4th century. His argument was based on government as the divine institution. If you believe that God is in the government and that God develops the government, which became the thinking in the 4th century, the emperor was the servant of God. God's servant, God's spokesman. And of course, a lot of the emperors claim they were God, literally. Ambrose is credited as the father of the just war doctrine. And the just war doctrine is jus ad bellum in the Latin, which means the principles of the justice of war are commonly held to be having just cause, being a last resort, being declared by a proper authority, possessing right intention, having a reasonable chance of success, and the end being proportional to the means used. If you use those excuses, you can justify any war. Let's face it. That was from the Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Let's look at our statement of belief on the subject of military service and war. We believe that Christians are forbidden by the commandments of God from taking human life directly or indirectly, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. Therefore, we believe that Christians should not voluntarily become engaged in military service. If they are involuntarily engaged in military service, we believe they should refuse conscientiously to bear arms and, to the extent possible, refuse to come under military authority. That is the church's statement of belief when it comes to military service and war. I'd like to talk just briefly about conscientious objection, because it's important to the American culture and American history. Conscientious objection has been recognized in America since 1661, when the Massachusetts colony made provisions for exempting men from military service on religious grounds, mainly the Puritans. Also, I might add, in Rhode Island, the first Sabbath keepers were conscientious objectors. In 1701, Pennsylvania gave the Quakers exemption in the colony of Pennsylvania because they were pacifists. During the Civil War, both sides gave exemptions for conscientious objection status to military service, both the Union and the Confederacy. President Lincoln recognized the CO status during the Civil War and recognized that men and women could refuse on religious grounds not to be conscripted into service. The Selective Service Act of 1917 officially recognized CO status. However, objectors had to perform non-combatant service to their country in lieu of military service. And sometimes, following the Act of 1917, which followed World War I, or coincided, I might add, with World War I, that sometimes that work looked more like prison camps. It was work camps that had been developed for conscientious objectors. They were spat upon, they were ridiculed, they often were considered rejects of society because they took that stand. I might add that when I was a young man of draft age, I went to college, I got a college exemption for 4 years, but when I came out of college, I had to report for the draft. And many of my friends reported to the draft at that time, and they claimed conscious objection, and several of them had to drive trucks for charitable organizations for 2 years. It was a 2-year service to their country. So they became a truck driver for Salvation Army or some other charitable service. Thankfully, the work camps have kind of been forced out of existence, and CEOs were now giving service to their country in a charitable way. In 1965, the Supreme Court expanded the conscious objection status to Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism. That's pretty recent, wouldn't you think? In 1967, a pretty famous guy, Muhammad Ali, claimed CO status, and he was arrested. And he fought that, and the Supreme Court made a decision that Muslims were indeed conscientious objectors. Of course, obviously, if you have somebody like Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, who's a pugilist and he's fighting all the time, you wonder, how can he claim he's opposed, you know, to taking the life of another human being? But he succeeded with the Supreme Court. And I suppose most of you know by now that Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali died last night at age 74. But he made history in a way that most people don't realize. He solidified the CO status for even minority religions. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. The question arises then, what about today? Are Christians pacifists? Like the Quakers, are we pacifists then? Well, a pacifist is defined as a person who is opposed to war or to violence of any kind. Is there or will there ever be a time when Christians will fight? Well, I read you the scripture in Matthew 18, verse 36, where Christ said, "If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight." Christians are not pacifists. We are not pacifists. Let me make that clear. And there will come a time in the future, and I would like to touch on a few of those scriptures very briefly, that we will fight. Let's go to Revelation 19, verse 11. Chapter 19, verse 11. Revelation 19, 11. Now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. When Christ returns to this earth, he will make war with the nations. But, as we will see very clearly, and I'm going to have to go through these verses pretty quickly, the kind of war that Christ makes is not conventional. When we join Christ in the air and return to this earth with him to fight this battle that's predicted here, he's not going to give you an AK-47. He's not going to give you an Uzi. Not going to put you on a tank. The methods of God's warfare are very effective and will be successful, but they're much different. He seeks peace. That's the overall objective. Verse 13, he was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. By necessity, peace will come from the war. Let's go to verse 14. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. For in the first resurrection, that's you and me. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and the wrath of Almighty God. It is the time of God's wrath, as we know. Just a couple of quick notes here from Barnes' notes about he shall rule them with a rod of iron comes from Psalms 2 and verse 9. As a shepherd does his flock. The reference is to such control as a shepherd employs in relation to his flock, which is protecting, guarding, defending. With the idea the flock is under his care. The term rod of iron is that the dominion would be strong or irresistible, as an iron scepter is one that cannot be broken or resisted. But it doesn't imply he's going to take the rod of the shepherd and swing it around and knock everybody's head in. The implication is something far different. A firm, irresistible force, like we might call the leaning elephant, is the way he will conquer. Further, Barnes' notes talks about the thoughts of the scripture are the church would be universal or would prevail everywhere on earth under Christ's direction. The ascendancy of the true religion would be irresistible, as firm as a government administered under a scepter of iron. And three, that it would be of a character of protection rather than force or violence. Let's go to Zechariah 14. Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah 14, verse 3 says, then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, as he fights in the day of battle, and in the day that his feet stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem from the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west. So God uses natural forces. What good is an army with tanks and military vehicles if there's a giant earthquake? What happens to soldiers that are lined up on the earthquake fault? I mean, think about it for a minute. God will use natural forces to fight. And the Mount of Olives will split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain will move toward the north and half toward the south. And I'm sure that along the way there will be messages to the army that's opposing Christ saying, have you had enough yet? I am here to bring peace. Let's go to verse 5. You shall flee through the mountain valley, for the mountain valley shall reach to Azel. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. So people will try to hide. They'll try to run. They'll try every ploy they have learned in the military service colleges. Let's go to verse 12. And this shall be the plague which the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh will dissolve while they stand in their feet, and their eyes will dissolve in the sockets, and their tongues will dissolve in their mouths. You see, God doesn't need AK-47s and 50 caliber machine guns. He doesn't need atomic weaponry. As long as people resist, he will use other means to subdue the resistors. Notice verse 13. It shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. Judah also will fight at Jerusalem. Now verse 15. Such also shall be the plague on the horse and the mule and on the camel and the donkey and on all the cattle that will be in the camps. And of course, if you don't have cattle, in a modern day translation of this application is, if you can't start your engine for your tank, your electronics don't work, how are you going to turn the turret? You know, on and on it goes. As we have experienced many times, technology fails us. Right? It's like when the pump goes out. Let's notice verse 16. It shall come to pass that everyone that is left of the nations which came against Jerusalem will go up from year to year and worship the king. People are going to go up because of that firm rod of iron, that irresistible force that God will represent. Verse 17 and 18, if there's pockets of rebellion, notice how it's handled. And it shall be that whoever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem for the feast to worship the Lord of hosts, on them will fall no rain. Once again, he'll use nature. Gives the example of the family of Egypt in verse 18. If they don't come up, no rain on their crops, guess what? Next year they'll be there. Let's go back to chapter 9 and verse 10 of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 10. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim. You know where a lot of the tanks that are in the Middle East are made? Britain. Kind of interesting. And the horse from Jerusalem, the bow, shall be cut off. He shall speak peace to the nations. His dominion shall be from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. Let's go to Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 2. Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains. That means the nation of Israel and Judah will be dominant because that's where Jerusalem is, that's where Christ is, King of kings and Lord of lords, and then shall be exalted above the hills. Peoples will flow to it. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for out of Zion the law goes forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Very clearly, we know in the end that God wins. Look at verse 3. Verse 3. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares. This statue, of course, sits outside of the United Nations building in New York. And I might just ask you, how successful has man been to bring peace, and to bring people to beat their swords into plowshares? Well, we just went through the facts of the fatalities in the last century since World War I. more people have died than the previous several hundred years. Only Christ can bring the success that I think people really want, the true peace. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. West Point, the Air Force Academy, they'll all be abolished and banned. Let's go to Isaiah 9. I'd like to end up here. Isaiah 9. Verses 6 and 7. We read the prophecy about Christ, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Father of Israel and Judah, Prince of Peace, Prince of Peace. What an enviable name, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it, to establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And God's promises will be brought to bear. I'd like to go back to those words of John Lennon. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. If we had a Memorial Day holiday in God's church, it would celebrate the lives of those who've died in the faith. Hebrews 11. Those who received God's Holy Spirit down through the ages, live lives of enduring faith, even to the point of death and martyrdom, like the apostles. And all the Christians who followed their teachings and received that same Spirit. But wait a minute. We do have a Memorial Day. It's next Sunday. We call it Pentecost. In 7 days, we will celebrate and rejoice in God's Memorial Day.